they always asked me. I had no clue. I just assumed they were forgetful. My mother finally reached her own conclusion. Nobody understands their English, concluded my mother, and they know that. 2 weeks after my 17th birthday, I was on an airplane bound for Paris. I was scheduled to arrive 2 days before the national celebration of the French Revolution, Bastille Day. I had never been so excited in my entire life. I couldn't wait to meet my host family. I couldn't wait to eat an authentic baguette. I couldn't wait to make French friends. This was going to be the best summer of my entire life, the kind of summer that somebody would want to make a movie out of. And as soon as I set foot in the Paris airport, I was whisked away by two gendarmes. I had no idea that traveling with an Iranian passport would qualify me for special treatment. These men found it odd that 3 years after the revolution, a 17-year-old Iranian should be traveling by herself and staying in Paris for 2 months. In a small, windowless room, I explained to them in French, but with a perky Southern California demeanor, all about the contest and how I had won and how much I was looking forward to seeing the Louvre and going to cafes and eating a crepe on a street corner. "You don't know anybody in Paris?" they asked me. "Did anyone give you any materials to distribute? How is it that you speak French so well if you are only a student of French? Do you plan on returning to America afterward?" These people clearly thought my life was a lot more exciting than it was. After answering all their questions, I had to endure the luggage search. My suitcase, roughly the size of a coffin, was on loan from Aunt Sedire. It had previously been used to transport two large Persian rugs and an entire samovar set from Iran. The gendarmes started sifting through the clothes and the myriad of gifts I had brought from my host family. When they reached the stuffed Minnie Mouse, they decided they had had enough. They zipped up my suitcase and politely wished me a nice stay. After my rendezvous with the welcoming committee, I searched the airport for someone carrying a sign with my name on it. Once I found her, I was greeted with, "Where have you been?" I explained to her that I was a VIP, a very Iranian person, and things just take longer for us. Before coming to Paris, I had corresponded once with my host family, mainly to find out what kinds of gifts to bring. Michel and Christiane were journalists working for Libération, a left-leaning newspaper. They also had a six-month-old daughter. I had envisioned myself spending evenings having enlightening discussions over home-cooked French meals. Pass the béarnaise sauce, please, and tell me again, Michel, what do you really think of the ramifications of industrialism in 19th-century France? Upon arriving, I gave them the gifts— the coffee table book on California, the signed limited edition print of the Ferris wheel on Balboa Island, the t-shirts from Newport Beach, the homemade chocolate chip cookies, the homemade baklava, and the large Minnie Mouse. Once my hosts had opened all the presents, Christiane blithely informed me that the next morning they would be leaving for the countryside, where they would be staying for the entire summer. But here were the keys to the apartment. She also told me the location of the nearest 24-hour market. I then did what any self-respecting person would do. I asked to go with them. "Non," replied Christiane. It became painfully obvious to me that there was to be no cultural exchange with these people. The only exchange they were interested in was the exchange of currency between them and the rental office. Michel and Christiane's small apartment on the Rue de Tourbigot was filled with books and magazines. Bookshelves lined every room. From Japanese art to Russian literature to the works of Dante and Joyce, every topic was covered, except, of course, hospitality. Had I not met Michel and Christiane, but simply stayed in their apartment, I probably would have liked them. The tiny bathroom came with a 3-year stack of Zoom, a photography magazine that prominently featured breasts in every pictorial, but in an intellectual way. For a spread on the disappearing tribes of Africa, The locals were featured alongside a lineup of topless Caucasian models wearing African masks. What better way to showcase the wildflowers of Provence than by painting a few topless models purple and placing them among the flowers? Even the ads followed the same theme. In a coffee ad, a dark-skinned model was featured sitting on a hill of beans. Both the beans and the model were naked. During my years as a French student, every textbook I had ever read had elaborated upon the unforgettable jubilance known as Bastille Day, the parade down the Champs-Élysées, the fireworks, the general merriment, and the cherished memories born only of this event. Sitting alone in the apartment the day after my arrival, I realized that I was going to be spending this momentous holiday by myself in a tiny apartment far away from the festivities. Since I knew nobody in Paris, I decided to go talk to the concierge to see if she had any ideas. According to my books on French culture, concierges were usually old ladies living alone on the ground floor of apartment buildings. They were usually pictured peeking from behind their lace curtains to see the comings and goings of the apartment dwellers. One is supposed to consult the concierge about the mail or a lost key, never for social advice. But I was desperate. I knocked on the door and was pleasantly surprised to be greeted by Noelle, a plump, jovial woman in her early 40s. I explained to her that I had just arrived in Paris from California and was looking for something to do on Bastille Day. The minute she heard the word California, she perked up even more. "Une Californienne!" she exclaimed. I didn't really want to disappoint her by pointing out that I was actually une Iranienne, so I just smiled. She wanted to know whether I lived near Hollywood and whether I knew any famous people. I explained to her that I lived an hour away from Hollywood. As for famous people, I thought of telling her that my father is directly descended from the Prophet Muhammad, but I knew that wasn't the kind of famous person she was inquiring about. Noelle told me to meet her the following night so we could go to the Champs-Élysées together. She said she couldn't wait. Neither could I. The next evening, I put on a Hawaiian shirt, jeans, and the spanking new Adidas sneakers I had bought for my trip. I knocked on Noelle's door, but the woman who answered bore no resemblance to the concierge I had met the night before. Noelle was clad in a body-hugging red knit dress that accentuated her ample curves. The plunging neckline barely covered her enormous chest. With each breath she took, I expected her bosom to just break free and come out to watch the parade with us. We started walking the three blocks to the metro station, catching the attention of every creepy male in the city of lights. As Noelle jiggled and wiggled down the street, I thought of just skipping the parade since we had managed to start our own. During the long metro ride, we sat surrounded by the kind of men I always associate with windowless vans bearing bumper stickers that say, "If this van's a-rockin', don't come a-knockin'." Unlike me, Noelle was completely enamored of the attention, although to her credit, she never talked to any of the men. She was too busy inquiring about California, and specifically California men. In search of a husband, she told me, she had recently moved to Paris from the countryside, but she was hugely disappointed with the men. According to her, they were all married. I was surprised that she had any minimum standards, since her dress and high heels gave the impression that anyone in possession of a simple set of one X and one Y chromosome would suffice. We reached the Champs-Élysées approximately 10 minutes after the rest of the population of Western Europe. Noelle and I moved around trying to find a good spot, but no matter where we went, all we could see was the backs of people's heads. I didn't think anything could be worse than the after-Christmas sale at Nordstrom, but I was clearly wrong. The parade started and ended. I saw nothing. Once the festivities were over, Noelle and I made our way to the metro station, only to find that the same 14 rows of people who had been ahead of us at the parade were now ahead of us in line for the train. "Pas de problème," chirped Noelle. "Nous chercherons un taxi." The idea of looking for a taxi was a fine one, except that apparently all the drivers had taken the night off. They'd probably been standing in front of us at the parade. After walking half a dozen blocks, Noelle suggested that we just walk the rest of the way home. It was 1 a.m. Normally, I cannot stay awake past 10 o'clock. My goal throughout high school was to stay up long enough to watch Saturday Night Live. I never made it. In college, my parents had no need to worry about my getting involved with drugs and alcohol, since by the time most parties started, I was in my third cycle of REM sleep. I am also legendary among my friends for my complete lack of a sense of direction, making me the perfect kidnap victim, no blindfold necessary. Drive me anywhere and I will be unable to find my way back. It was therefore a great irony that I found myself in a foreign city trying to make my way home way past my bedtime. I spent the entire walk home making deals with God. If you just get me home, I will never ask for anything again. Between conversations with the Almighty, I listened for the click-click of Noelle's heels, a Morse code of sorts, to guide me back to the Rue de Tourbigot. By then, we had run out of conversation, or rather, Noelle had nothing more to say about men. Much to her disappointment, I didn't have much to contribute on the topic, since I was, to put it kindly, a late bloomer. School started a few days later. The classes, like the Bastille Day parade, were a huge disappointment. All my teachers were in their early 20s, and none seemed very interested in teaching. Perhaps they resented being stuck in Paris during the summer, a season when the French normally evacuate the capital. One teacher spent the whole time flirting with the men in class while completely ignoring the women. Another made us translate the lyrics of the works of Jacques Brel, a famous performer whose songs would have been appropriate for Suicide, the musical. We spent hours plodding through the songs while our teacher sat with a far-off look in her eyes. My English versions did not do them justice, but then again, the teacher had a certain hands-off style of teaching, a style that translated into her sitting in the corner, recalling perhaps a summer spent elsewhere. She helped us only reluctantly, as when none of our dictionaries had the word putain, slang for prostitute. With apologies to Monsieur Brel, the song, Jeff. No, Jeff, you're not alone. Stop crying like that in front of everyone, because a fake blonde dumped you yet again. No, Jeff, you're not alone, but I'm ashamed to see you cry shamelessly in front of everybody, because a three-quarter whore popped out of your life. Then we moved on to Fernande, a funerary march. To think that Fernande is dead, to think that Fernande has died, to think that I'm the only one behind, to think that he's the only one in front. Him in his last beer, me in my fog, him in his hearse, me in my desert. By the end of that song, we were able to conjugate the verb to die in every tense. Had I made some friends during my melancholic French lessons, I would have at least been a few degrees happier than Jeff or Fernande. Unfortunately, the students in my classes were quite a bit older than I was, and most were newly arrived immigrants struggling to learn French. These were not people hoping to find Gertrude Stein's favorite haunt. They were hoping to find a job. The few interesting people I did meet were leaving in 3 days to go somewhere else. No one, except for the people selling keychains under the Eiffel Tower, actually stayed in Paris during the summer. The upside of my lonely 2 months was that I became completely fluent in French. Having loads of free time, I also managed to see just about every museum in the city. Whatever culture I lacked after having spent 6 years in Southern California, I more than made up for. The downside of my summer was realizing that maybe the joys of being 17, even in Paris, were highly exaggerated. I wondered if the summer somehow foreshadowed the rest of my life. Maybe I was doomed to a really lonely existence, where the only pleasure came not from human company, but from croissants. Maybe someday I would end up thinking Jacques Brel's lyrics were uplifting. A few months after my return to California, I received a letter from Noelle letting me know that she had moved to New Caledonia, where, according to her, the ratio of men to women was 5 to 1. I remembered her kindness in taking me to the Champs-Élysées on Bastille Day to fulfill one of my dreams. Granted, she had mistaken me for a real Californian, someone who perhaps knew Paul Newman or Cher. But in exchange for making one of my dreams come true, I sincerely hoped that she would find Monsieur Merveilleux waiting for her on that little island in the Pacific. If someone were to make a movie of my summer in Paris, it would not be the touching coming-of-age film I had hoped for, but rather a black and white filled with close-ups of furrowed brows and croissant crumbs. There would be no theme song, just the sound of the metro doors opening and closing and opening and closing. Against this backdrop of teenage angst, there would have to be a symbol, a representation of the confidence that comes with eventual intellectual and spiritual growth. This would, bien sûr, be most effectively depicted by the judicious scattering of topless models in the background. The wedding. My marriage started out with a big, fat lie. I told my parents that François' family was happy about our engagement. I had to. In the Iranian culture, fathers will consent to a marriage only if the future groom and his family worship the bride. There is no getting around this detail. If there's any problem with the groom's family, forget it. Engagement off, moving on to the next suitor. When I first started dating François, his mother declared that I would never be allowed to set foot in her house. This was before she met me. Before meeting me, François had a longtime French girlfriend. From all accounts, she was an intelligent and capable person, but she was Jewish. Her religion was a problem until François started dating me. Compared to a Muslim, the Jewish girlfriend didn't seem so bad after all. I once asked François if there was anybody he could have dated that would have bothered his mother more. Well, he said, a black communist bisexual would have really irked her. My parents had a completely different reaction to François. They first heard of him during the summer after my junior year in college, 6 months after we had met. For 5.5 of those months, François and I had known we were going to get married, but had not said anything to our parents. I had simply informed my parents that I was dating somebody, and I wanted them to meet him. Dating, like the rodeo circuit or trout farming, is a completely foreign concept to my parents. They, like all their sisters and brothers, never dated, their marriages having been arranged by family members. My mother learned what she knows about dating from Days of Our Lives, especially Hope and Beau's tumultuous relationship. The only dates my father knew about contained pits. The first time they met François, my parents insisted on taking him to the nicest Persian restaurant in Los Angeles. My father ordered the appetizer sampler, which François ate with gusto while questioning my mother about the ingredients. Is this spiced sumac? Are these the thin-skinned Persian cucumbers? Is the feta made with sheep's milk? Once the appetizers were finished, François selected the most copious dish on the menu, the sultani, a combination of lamb, beef, and chicken kebab on an enormous mound of rice. His order arrived, looking as though someone had just grilled an entire petting zoo. François ate and ate and ate. My father asked me, in Persian, whether he always ate like this. My mother said, in Persian, that she hoped he wasn't going to get sick. Meanwhile, François kept eating. By the time he was done, there was not a grain of rice left on his large oval plate. My mother told him how lucky he was that he could eat enough food for 3 people and not be fat. François was of normal weight, although he did outweigh me, which fulfilled one of 2 requirements for dating a guy. The other requirement was a total lack of interest in watching sports on television. François fulfilled that one, too. Unbelievably, he ordered dessert, exclaiming that he couldn't possibly imagine skipping the rose water and pistachio ice cream. By then, I was just hoping that if he did throw up, it wouldn't happen in my father's car. Once we arrived at my house, I asked François why he had eaten so much. I know that Middle Easterners love to feed people, and I wanted to make a good impression on your parents, he said, but I need to go lie down now. My parents did like François, not because of his appetite for Persian food, but because he was kind and because I was in love with him. My mother had always hoped that I would marry an Iranian doctor, someone whom she could speak to without an interpreter, a man whose parents would consider me the best thing that had ever happened to their son. She had held steadfastly to her dream.